to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these €2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The first commercial flight has landed at Sana'a International Airport almost 7 years after the Saudi-led coalition forced the facility to shut down its ordinary air travel. The opening takes place 6 weeks behind the schedule after a UN brokered ceasefire was enforced in early April. This is due to repeated delays by the Saudi-led coalition under different pretexts.
Today, the first civilian plane has arrived at Sana'a Airport after a closure that lasted for more than 6 years, and there is a flight that will go to Amman Airport in Jordan carrying 130 passengers. The turnout is large, and people are eager to travel through Sana'a Airport amid the exceptional circumstances and the large number of patients. We call on the United Nations and all international organizations to demand that the Saudi-led coalition stop its siege and open the airport without any restrictions.
Officials say thousands of patients are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Keeping the airport closed has pushed many Yemeni patients desperate to seek medical treatment abroad to the brink amid their critical health conditions.
We were not able to travel through another airport because of the difficulty of traveling by road and the rugged roads. As my health situation was critical and I couldn't take the long way to another city.
There was a deliberate delay by the Saudi-led coalition to operate flights through Sana'a's airport, especially since 41 days have passed since the implementation of the UN brokered truce. We hope that Yemeni civilians will profit from the opening of the airport, that the truce will be extended, and that the airport will continue to be operational, as it's a civilian airport that does not serve any military authority.
Under the two-month truce that was brokered by the United Nations at the beginning of April, there should be two flights from Egypt and Jordan and back there every week. However, the truce will end in 2 weeks and the terms of the armistice have not yet been implemented.
People here hope that the UN brokered truce will be extended and that Sana'a International Airport will always be open to humanitarian flights, as it is a humanitarian necessity to save the lives of thousands of patients, including children, who are waiting for the chance to travel abroad for treatment. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was supposed to ensure seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island. The most recent reason, the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party, Sinn Féin, came top for the first time ever. The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who wanted to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy in the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
The Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the post-Brexit withdrawal agreement, aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it. But to the EU, that is anathema.
The unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place.
Boris Johnson clearly wanted to get Brexit done. And so he promised just about anything to the unionists to get them to agree. At the same time, the unionists had a vested interest in staying good friends with the British, the Westminster government, because a rift with them would be very damaging for the unionist cause. Now they've got to live with those consequences.
It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government, led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and unionists in Northern Ireland, and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Sharing the same mindset toward the US, Iran and Cuba are set to expand their partnership. Cuba's Deputy Prime Minister Ricardo Cabrizas made this comment in Tehran at the 18th meeting of the Iran-Cuba Joint Economic Commission.
I would like to reiterate Cuba's resolute will to expand its ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran in all areas. We are here to find solutions to illegal measures taken against us by our common enemy.
Iran and Cuba have already had close ties in the health sector. Pastokovac is a COVID vaccine produced jointly by Iranian and Cuban biotech firms. The two sides now hope to build on this successful cooperation and extend it to other fields.
Pastokovac's been one of the major vaccines that are injected to our people today. It's a result of successful joint efforts made by Iranian and Cuban scientists. We're determined to adopt the same synergy in other fields as well.
The 17th meeting of the Joint Economic Commission of the two countries was held in Havana in December 2016, shortly after the conclusion of the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus one. Everything was going to change for better, but the reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, following the U.S. pullout from the deal, killed all chances for Iran and Cuba to do business smoothly.
Despite their long-standing ties in scientific and political areas, Tehran and Havana have not done well when it comes to bilateral trade. Last year, Iran's exports to Cuba were almost zero, with its imports standing at a trivial $2,500. Both sides are now poised to give it a jump start, but they need to overcome stringent U.S. sanctions targeting both countries.
Cruel and inhumane was how the two officials described U.S. sanctions. However, both are determined to, quote, neutralize the embargoes using non-dollar channels such as bartering.
Iran and Cuba's common enemies will never succeed in trying to stop our revolutionary development. We will work together with Iran to adopt bartering and other banking mechanisms that will render ineffective and United States illegal and unilateral economic measures against our nations.
Based on Cabrisa's three-day itinerary, the two sides will sign agreements in the fields of oil and petrochemical industry, mining and nanotechnology, among others. Closer ties with Cuba, among other Latin American countries, come as part of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's new approach toward foreign policy and his attempt to avoid tying the economy to the 2015 deal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A 74-second siren was sounded across the West Bank at 12 noon local time, marking the 74 years that have passed since their Nakba, the catastrophe. Demonstrators from all walks of life and of all ages held maps of historical Palestine and large metal keys to symbolize their homes from which were forced to leave decades ago. The anniversary also comes as anger is boiling over the Israeli killing of prominent Al Jazeera veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akle.
Nakba anniversary has always been painful to all the Palestinians, and this year is more painful. Like every year, we commemorate our Nakba to tell the world that our homeland is unforgettable. That's why you can see people are still holding the keys to their ancestors' homes, as they still believe that they will return to their homes one day, and hopefully it'll be very soon.
Nearly 5 million Palestinian refugees remain scattered in different camps in the besieged Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, Lebanon, Jordan and Syria, including others dispersed around the world. All of them have a mutual dream, which is returning to historical Palestine.
Since 1948, Palestinians have remained steadfast in defending their right to return to their homeland despite Israel's continued ethnic cleansing policies. For Palestinians, Nakba remains a painful episode in history, and the agony continues to be felt amid Israel's escalated violence and crimes. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Yet again, London streets have been brought to a standstill by pro-Palestinian activists calling for an end to Israeli crimes against humanity in the occupied territories. Such events are building momentum, and the calls for the last apartheid on earth to be dismantled are growing louder.
Atrocities are committed in the occupied Palestinian territories on a daily basis, from ethnic cleansing to murder. And for decades, Western media has managed to downplay the severity of the situation. But now, with social media and so many cameras recording the madness, it's almost impossible to bury the truth.
Only days earlier, a prominent Palestinian journalist died when she was shot in the face by Israeli forces. She was reporting on an army raid in the West Bank. Her death caused outrage, and scenes of her coffin bearers being beaten by Israelis made headlines. 229 rights groups have called for Israel to be held accountable for what they call a premeditated assassination. At Saturday's protest, Shirin Abu Akleh's life and work was honoured.
I feel that we have the duty to come here and to do that and to speak out. For example, just Shirin the other day was murdered, and all the reports, the news channels, they're reporting it as clashes. Even in her funeral, the clips that I saw were disgusting. And still, again, the way that they are being reported is as clashes. Now, Germany, they wanted to hold a protest for the murdered journalist, but Germany was not allowing them to do so.
There is a trade relation between Britain and Israel, which includes arms sales. So this country, Britain, buys armaments from Israel, which are being announced as tested on Palestinian people. So people always think that Britain is arming Israel, but it is not a one-way street. Britain is also buying arms from Israeli arms companies. And there are Israeli arms companies who are operating in Britain as well. They're producing in Britain.
A raft of new measures limiting public protest were recently added to the already controversial policing bill, and it might also become illegal to boycott, divest and sanction entities like Israel, robbing public bodies of their right to make ethical decisions. It's the information age, and it remains to be seen how the UK hopes to maintain its democratic persona now that its grip on the media has loosened. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As higher oil prices mean more oil pumping, all of the big names of Iran's oil industry have assembled here to multiply the country's oil output amid rising crude prices. the 26th edition of the International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition brought together 1,200 Iranian and 44 international firms active in upstream, midstream and downstream oil sectors.
We produce a range of medium pressure and high pressure cables, lead sheet head cables for use in petrochemical industries and oil and gas. We have been operating since 1992 and have been supplying our domestic oil firms with our cables, which otherwise would have to go through the process of importing from other countries amid the complications caused by the sanctions.
Our company has been running for 39 years in the production of more than 400 types of metal fasteners and holders from various materials such as iron, copper, aluminum, stainless steel and alloy, among others. We have worked with major foreign companies supplying them with insulation, pipe clamps, cold line shoes, and so on.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by the U.S. and China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran have made it almost impossible to import quality bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This has forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery, including drilling bits. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
NATO critics say the alliance's expansion is what led to the war in Ukraine, and now moves are afoot to provoke Moscow even further. It looks almost certain that Finland, and most probably Sweden, are to join NATO. Via video link, senior Helsinki officials set out their case to the European Parliament on Thursday as to why Finland would fit right in.
Finland has many high-end capabilities, including a fighter jet fleet of F-80s, gradually to be replaced by recently ordered 64 F-35 jet fighters.
Sweden's Malin Björk asked, what's the rush given that her country and Finland have said they don't feel under immediate threat? However, it seems most EU lawmakers are supportive.
We think that it is not only defining for Finnish security, but it's only an important step in European history.
Finland's border with Russia stretches for 1,300 kilometres. Membership would mean NATO's land border with the Federation would more than double. The Kremlin has warned there will be military retaliation if the plan goes ahead. Experts aren't ruling out the possibility of World War III.
This creates a major problem, because when you change the architecture of security, of course, you create waves of reaction and perceived threats, which is the case for Russia now.
The US and its European allies are spending enormous amounts of money on arming Ukraine. One EU lawmaker criticized this during Thursday's proceedings.
We have a very powerful arms industry in the European Union, and many nations rely on arms exports. We should be doing all we can to prevent conflicts escalating instead.
Analysts say it could take up to a year for Finland to fully join NATO, but in the meantime, it will become a de facto member. The question is, in the event of escalation, will it be viewed as protected or as a target? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson lacks the authority to fix the problems that his protocol has created in Northern Ireland. Meanwhile, the people of Northern Ireland are suffering. We now present you an article written by Simon Jenkins. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian, and it's titled, Boris Johnson created this Brexit mess in Northern Ireland, and he should own it. Two of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's most reckless chickens are coming home to roost. To get hard Brexit into law and topple his predecessor, Theresa May, he told Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party, DUP, that it would allow no border in the Irish Sea. He promptly allowed one and signed a protocol to the Brexit deal to that effect. An enraged DUP is duly refusing to let the new Northern Irish executive take office until that border goes. Boris Johnson is now threatening to unilaterally renege on the protocol, in turn enraging the European Union by flagrantly breaching the withdrawal deal. Precisely this trap was built into hard Brexit from day one. Everyone knew it. It was classic Boris Johnson. He lied his way out of each scrape, sacking or ennobling colleagues according to taste. The absence of a new executive in Belfast leaves open the prospect of direct rule from London. If Boris Johnson fails to dismantle the EU-ordained border controls at Belfast docks, the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, will stall power sharing. If he gives in and allows the world's goods to flow freely into the Irish Republic, the European Union has threatened to retaliate in an all-out trade war. The question is, what new constructive ambiguity, a euphemism for fudge, Boris Johnson can conceivably fashion to get him out of this mess? Amid all the shouting and screaming of Brexit, quiet voices were warning, don't forget Northern Ireland. The Brexiters dismissed it as a historical trifle. Since the United Kingdom would have tariff-free trade with the European Union, the Irish border would be frictionless, no problem. The deceits of hard Brexit, none was more blatant than the word frictionless. Boris Johnson in effect ceded authority over the 40% of Britain's trade, that is, with the European Union, under the pretense that he was taking back control. But it takes two to trade. 100-page forms and hours-long queues at Dover have been the result, with similar friction at Belfast border. The Marks and Spencer's chairman, Archie Norman, protested recently that a staggering 700 pages of forms is required to get two trucks across the Irish Sea from England, requiring 8 hours of work by 20 staff. The reality is that any border is a border, offering any number of impediments to trade. The European Union was furious at hard Brexit. What on earth made Boris Johnson think it would make life easier? The Prime Minister's first decision must be to call the bluff of the Democratic Unionist Party's intransigent leader, Geoffrey Donaldson. Stony-faced unionists have been the bane of British Prime Ministers back to Lloyd George. In 1921, the territory was gerrymandered to deliver a perpetual unionist majority, and the resulting one-party rule has caused Britain little but trouble. At this month's local elections, that historic act of gerrymandering failed. An exhausted electorate in Northern Ireland split the unionist vote three ways. Sinn Féin has emerged in pole position. It could one day lead Northern Ireland, with care, towards eventual reunion with the South. Geoffrey Donaldson faces an existential threat and has nothing to lose. The Good Friday Agreement of 1998 achieved peace by embedding power sharing between the nationalist and unionist constituencies. With each side having a veto, it has constantly broken down and cannot survive formally without the leading unionist bloc, the DUP, in play. At the same time, Northern Ireland's government is reportedly a shambles. In particular, its health service is delivering some of the worst outcomes of any part of the United Kingdom. Just recently, it was reported that the number of people waiting for more than 12 hours in accidents and emergencies had doubled in a year. Somehow, the logjam must be cleared. Boris Johnson has to demand that DUP's leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, must return to Stormont or that Northern Ireland must be ruled without him. Until power sharing returns, with First Minister designate Michelle O'Neill in post, London must find a mechanism for re-establishing the executive, with a role for Michelle O'Neill. This might involve some sort of ghost executive until the formal aegis in the Northern Ireland secretary. The reality is that democracy in Northern Ireland is starting to change, and in a welcome and more open direction. London has ruled its Irish territory abominably for over a century. It owes it help towards a new dawn. The short-term question remains whether Boris Johnson can say anything to the Unionists sufficient to entice them back. For most in Northern Ireland, the border is not the chief political issue. It has been replaced by the cost of living crisis and the state of the health service. By the same token, it is clearly worth attempting yet again to plead with Brussels's better nature to find some partial compromise on the border question. The present controls are indefensible. Hard Brexit was a mistake, a crude and casual gesture by Boris Johnson to prop up his leadership bid. He showed no sign of knowing what hard might entail. But then there were few Remainers ready to support soft Brexit as a halfway house. As it is, Brussels negotiators have clearly been instructed to play tough, subjecting British trade to a nightmare of barriers and bureaucracy. These are palpably beyond anything needed to protect standards, health and safety. At the same time, there is no reason for Britain not to accede to standards that it has shared with the rest of the continent for half a century. The proposals reputedly offered by the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss to ease the Belfast border are reasonable but inoperable, in the absence of the European Union's agreement. They embrace licensed, trusted traders and red and green lanes for vehicles intended to go on to Ireland and those remaining in Northern Ireland. A modicum of supervision should be able to protect the European Union from global trade contamination. There is no need to chase trawlers across the high seas or follow British number plates through the lanes of Louth and Donegal. Surely, there is compromise somewhere here. Europe has enough on its hands without the distraction of a childish trade war with Britain. Yes, Britain is to blame. It chose to leave the European Union, but the European Union should respect that. In addition, Boris Johnson personally interpreted Brexit as leaving Europe's economic trade area, for which he had no mandate. That decision is costing Britain dearly, and one day will have to be corrected. For the moment, Prime Minister owes it to Northern Ireland to free it from the mess into which hard Brexit has condemned it. In doing so, he would yet set it on the road to political reconstruction. That, at least, would be a silver lining on the Brexit cloud.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The surging cost of living in the UK is taking a heavy toll on the people's health. According to a YouGov poll, 55% of Britons complain about the worsening health due to such factors as heating and food costs. Retailers have also warned that food price inflation could hit 10% in Britain this year. The Bank of England governor has admitted he is unable to stop inflation hitting 10%.
The UK government's latest data shows the unemployment rate has fallen to a new five-decade low, with the value of wages going down amid rising inflation. The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, says the two main drivers of inflation are energy and global goods prices resulting from the Ukraine war. He has warned that the fallout from surging prices will cause unemployment to increase. He described the situation surrounding soaring food costs as apocalyptic.
I'm afraid the one that I am going to sound, I guess, rather apocalyptic about is food. I think two things that the Ukrainian finance minister said. One is Ukraine does have food in store, but it can't get it out at the moment. Two, while he was optimistic about crop planting, he was pretty optimistic about planting, interestingly, but he said at the moment, you know, we have no way of shipping it out.
Bailey also warned of a very real income shock. While average wages are rising in the UK, the government says they continue to sink in real terms as Britain, like others, faces runaway inflation. The Bank of England also warned that Brexit has made the bad situation worse, saying that leaving the EU will continue to have a negative effect on the economy. Consumer price inflation was at 7% last month, the highest in 30 years, while the energy price cap rose by 54%. The Bank of England expects further price rise will push the economy close to recession by the end of 2022. It says the inflation may top 10% by December. A British think tank, Resolution Foundation, has warned that UK households are facing a cost of living catastrophe. A survey conducted by Ipsos also shows that one in three Brits say they have missed meals recently because of surging inflation. According to the poll, two in three people in the country are turning off their heating system. The surge has also taken a heavy toll on the health sector, with 55% of Britons surveyed saying their health has worsened due to the skyrocketing cost of living. Chancellor of Exchequer Rishi Sunak has raised pressure to do more now to address the crisis facing many households. The Bank of England has already raised its interest rate to tackle the prices. Its key rate now stands at the highest level since the global financial crisis in 2009. But analysts say that's too little, too late.
So the Bank of England missed the opportunity to avoid all this some time ago. All right, it should have been raising interest rates substantially some time ago. All right, and it's too little too late. And in fact, this 1% is not going to make any difference. All right, interest rates at 1% with inflation headed to 10. As I say, in economics, we call it a negative real return of 9%. All right, so in fact, you've got savers are getting killed. All right, because they're earning 1%, but the cost of living is going up 10%.
Millions in Britain now face one big question: how to make ends meet, as many believe the crisis has barely begun and the situation will get much worse in the coming weeks and months.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. And as you've noticed, we're going to discuss British economic woes. Let me introduce our guests in this episode. Journalist, author and activist Fra Hughes is joining us out of Belfast. With us, we'll also have historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling in Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Farah, let me start asking you this question. The BOE governor mentioned that rising prices for energy and goods as cause of inflation. He stressed the shocks such as the Russian invasion of Ukraine and also the impact of China's zero COVID policy. Now, what factors do you blame for the situation in the UK?
Well, I believe that what we're maybe witnessing now is also part of the capitalist global kind of boom bust that comes along every 10 years. I mean, it was 2007 since the last real recession came in because of the kind of financial irregularities around the subprime housing market in America and stuff. In Britain at the minute, housing is probably higher than it was before the previous financial collapse. So I think it's worth maybe repeating that, you know, with the Bank of England interest rates only at 1%, it still means that people can borrow money at very low rates. And as people begin to struggle to pay their bills and to meet their commitments, and the rent sector is beginning to go through the roof. So we've got, you know, high house prices, very high rent, stagnant wages, inflation going up. Money is still relatively easy to get on credit, which in itself could become a long-term time bomb for the people who find themselves in difficulty. But it's a neoliberal austerity that's been followed by the Conservative Party, perhaps, and the Labour Party, actually, from Margaret Thatcher for nearly 40 years, that have led to the demise of public services, the health service, education. I think it's almost like a perfect storm that with inflation going up and alongside the kind of extraordinary rise in energy prices and the government refusing to bring in a windfall tax on the money that's being made by the energy utilities in order to defer the price raises for the average consumer and the families in Britain. I think, to paraphrase what the governor of the Bank of England said, is apocalyptic. We have more food banks than we've ever had. We have more homeless people than we've ever had. And if employment does rise, then you will find more people in difficulty with their mortgages. You will find more house repossessions. You will find more families breaking up due to the financial strain. You'll have more children hungry going to school. It's a nightmare in the making, and a lot of it could be pointed at America's coup in Ukraine in 2014. And when America can afford to give $44 billion in weapons, lethal aid to the Ukraine, what does that say about the people who are suffering under the economic sanctions that are rebounding in Western Europe and America due to their short-sighted political falling and falling out with Russia that is causing all these problems for their own citizens?
Okay. Well, yes, Farah, as you just mentioned, there are many, many factors involved. We'll discuss some of them in more details later on in the show. Now, Tony, the Bank of England also saying that the Brexit has made a bad situation worse. So what do you think about the impact of this Brexit and divorce deal on the British economy?
Isn't it interesting? Because the previous governor of the Bank of England said he thought Brexit was going to make almost no difference whatsoever to the British economy, because things would still be being traded across the Channel, and that it is the much bigger factors that will make things, for example, these massive sanctions on Russia, because the way this is being framed is that it's the Ukrainian war that's caused this. No, it's the reaction to the Ukrainian war by the West. Britain particularly has spearheaded this reaction. That is to say, boycotting all these necessities that Britain and the rest of the West need from Russia. So in a way, they've brought this situation upon themselves by overreacting. But I also want to say, this isn't just a one-off. It's not an accident. This is something that's been being framed for years. And if you look just, you know, back 6 months or so, we saw two things happening. One was a big warning back in August, September here in 2021 in the UK that there was going to be a massive hike in fuel prices. Well, no explanation was given for that, but we now know what's happened. We also had all the troops brought back from Afghanistan. Nobody was really told why that was, but now we know. And that is because the West was preparing the provocation of the invasion of the Donbass in Ukraine right the way back at the autumn of last year. And they knew that the Russians would have to react as NATO and the Ukrainian army prepared to invade the Donbass in Ukraine. And so I think they knew that all this was going to happen and it's been prepared. So the main, I also agree with Finian very much that rent plays a very important part. We keep hearing about the increase in fuel prices, the energy prices going up 50%. It's roughly 25% for the petrol and diesel prices. But actually, rent is the killer. And rent is so ridiculously high in Britain. It's the average, right? And that is including the people who own their own homes. Is one third of people's income they're having to spend on their rent. So they've got very little, and that is mortgage repayments too. Mm-hmm. So they've got very little. Most of the population have got very little. Many have got nothing left after they've finished paying their rent. So the idea that these other things like energy and fuel are going up has basically tipped them underneath, basically put them into the red. You know, so they are now unable through going to work to pay enough money to live. And this is a deadly serious situation. And, of course, it means that they won't be paying tax. Therefore, the government is going to have less tax revenue and the government's going to go further into the black. Yeah. But we've just had this week an announcement from Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Conservative MP, chairman of the Privy Council, and he was the leader of the House as well, Conservative, of course, that we're going to be sacking 90,000 civil servants. So that's taking a fantastic amount out of the economy again. That money that those civil servants would have been paid, would have been spending. And so there, it seems to me as if they're deliberately, basically committing harakiri, suiciding the economy. Alex Craner, the analyst, he's a former hedge fund manager, was saying it's like a suicide pact. And the catalyst for all of this over the last few months has been the deliberate imposition of massive sanctions on Russia, even though, of course, Ukraine is not a NATO country. And, you know, that, I think, is basically what's going on. And Britain is the fifth richest country in the world, according to most of the metrics. And so what, if you look at it, if you take a step back at this and look, what you'll see is that the what's happening is the wealth is being hoarded by the wealthy. They're using their lobbying power and wealth in order to impoverish the rest of the nation. So it's setting the rich against the poor, and the divide is getting bigger and bigger by the minute.
Yeah. Now, Fry, there are some people who argue that the worst is yet to come for Britain, you know, citing the post-Brexit tensions that are growing wider with the EU over the Northern Ireland Agreement. You know, the administration talked about making some changes to the protocol, and the EU is warning against it, and also warning of the harsh repercussions for that.
Yes, well, we've had, I live in Belfast, so we've had Boris Johnson visiting yesterday. It's interesting that he chose to visit the Calais armament factory in East Belfast. They make component parts for the Javelin missiles, I think they're anti-tank missiles. So he was over cheering on the boys and girls making the bombs and the missiles that are going to be used on Russian soldiers and the people defending the Donbass against the fascist incursions from Kiev. But I think what we have here and what we're witnessing is this, in many respects, is just normal politics. This is Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and it's also Geoffrey Donaldson of the Democratic Unionist Party here in the north of Ireland. They are just playing a game of chicken and brinkmanship, and this is very well Boris Johnson. Cause the destabilised peace process here, and that is caused by the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, that will have to change. But what we're talking about is a small rump of loyalist, extremist, reactionary paramilitaries who would rather die than see there be some form of a second-class citizenship for them within the United Kingdom. And we have Geoffrey Donaldson and the DUP refusing to go into government with Sinn Féin and the other parties until the protocol is scrapped. So Boris Johnson and Liz Truss several weeks ago said they were going to rip up the Northern Ireland Protocol, that they were going to bring in legislation that would supersede that international agreement. Now they're saying that they want to continue talks with the EU to settle the outstanding issues, and that basically their legislation would be an insurance policy. But it's really a threat to the EU. Do what we want or we will act unilaterally. I don't believe for a second Boris Johnson and the United Kingdom Parliament and Cabinet will do that. And I feel that Boris Johnson, along with the choreography that's taking place here, are just trying to use the leverage of the threat of violence here in the north of Ireland to force the EU's hand. And I think they're following along suggestions from the DUP that we don't need to have border checks on the island of Ireland. We don't need to have a hard border within Ireland, that there can be some form of electronic monitoring of vehicles and goods travelling from the north of Ireland to the south of Ireland. But I don't believe that the British government fully intends to change the Northern Ireland Protocol. It's just politics and bluff and bluster.
Okay. Now, Tony, Bank of England was also blaming this Russia-Ukraine war for some of the woes in the British economy. But the UK was already facing energy price hikes even before the Russian military operation began in Ukraine, if you remember. So what was responsible for that issue? And then how did it spiral into this situation we're facing now?
Well, I mean, we didn't really have much in the way of price hikes in terms of energy. It was just that it was announced that the United States would be supplying more of our energy. And the Russians would be supplying less. That was announced last year. So goodness knows why. I think they want to kind of put, for the Americans, they want to put sanctions on Russia. But I have to disagree about the protocol, the Northern Ireland Protocol. I think this is going to go. At the moment, there's a sizable, it's difficult to know whether it's a majority or a minority. And it doesn't, it includes some people from both of the different sides of the divide. That is to say, the nationalist community in Northern Ireland, who generally want to stay with Ireland, they were going to send migrants who came across the English Channel from France over to Rwanda. It basically hasn't happened. It's an empty announcement, and this really does explain how I think it illustrates how little power the British government really has, and how little handle Boris Johnson has on the nation. I don't think he has. People who are really running things over here are the big corporations, the oil companies that put a fuel crisis on at the time of the party political broadcasts last year, the party conferences, sorry. We had these fuel price hikes almost to send a message to the political parties about who's really in charge. And when you've got weak government, it's the banks, the banksters, the City of London and the big corporations who are really in charge. At the end of the day, though, we've got 500,000 children now in absolute poverty. That means that the parents have to start claiming benefits, food banks, things like this in order to feed their children. And this is, as I say, the fifth richest country in the world. So it's clear what's going on. The rich are just starving the poor. And we've got, answer to all of this here in Bristol. I was very amused the other day to see they're putting up signs in Southmead, which is one of the poorest districts in the city, with smiling faces on, saying, "Be happy. This is our happy city." In fact, there's even an organisation which is putting these happy city messages out. And of course, this is what the government, in its very patronising manner, has been funding, and our local government here in Bristol, in order to sort of tell people, it's okay, it doesn't matter if you're in poverty and you've got no prospects for your children's future, you can just smile and be happy. So it's horrifically horrifically patronising. So I think the main culprits behind all this, of course, are the City of London. They are running the country for their own private profit and as an investment place, and they've really lost sight of the needs and the interests of the population.
Okay. Now, we have 1 or 2 minutes left. There is this YouGov poll indicating the cost of living taking a heavy toll on people's health. 55% of Britons say their health has worsened due to heating and food costs. So what measures has Downing Street taken to address those issues?
Well, I don't think it's taken any. As I mentioned earlier on, there's no windfall tax, which you would think would be the first thing a government that's concerned about its citizens would bring in. I mean, huge, huge, almost immoral, obscene profits are being made by these utility companies, and nothing is being given back to the people. I can imagine, I mean, even long before this in Britain, every winter, there were thousands of senior citizens who are maybe on a basic state pension, who had to decide between heating their homes and in eating their dinner. And people would die each year. People were found in their homes with the heating turned off because they'd either run out of money or couldn't afford it, and they were just sitting in their front rooms or lying in bed with extra blankets and extra coats to try and keep them warm. I can understand how people's health is beginning to suffer, because if you're under stress, financial strain, you're worried about how you're going to put food on the table for your children, how you're going to clothe your kids, how you're going to sort out their extra curricular school activities. I mean, stress is probably one of the biggest inducers of strokes, heart attacks and suicides in Western Europe, in first world countries. So I think that this huge burden that the government is placing onto the shoulders of its citizens is going to have a devastating...
Okay, we're running out of time. Tony, only 30 seconds. Sorry, Fra, for jumping in. 30 seconds.
Use the word apocalyptic to describe the food shortages potentially in the future. Now, this is a very important word. He's not used this word accidentally. This is a biblical reference to the book of Revelation, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And what worries me is that actually the third horse, the black horse, if you go down to the Bible and have a look, talks about food shortages. It talks about massive rising prices for basic foods, and it talks about famine. So I think we should take his warning seriously. What he's basically, I think, signaling is that he doesn't have any ability to control this situation now, and it may well be running out of control. And we may be looking at literally the sorts of signs that are written about in the New Testament about the horrific kind of situation that could bring about a kind of crisis in the whole of civilization.
Sorry for jumping.
So
that's
interesting
all the
time word to
we
use,
have.
Isn't it? Apocalyptic.
I'm sorry for interrupting. That's all the time we have. Journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes joined me from Belfast. Historian, investigative journalist Tony Gosling from Bristol with their insight.